Faith, hope, and just a bit of spookiness allow many mysteries to endure. The mystical places, people, and objects we will talk about today are just legendary. This is your host, Danny, and this is a new episode from Great Mysteries. We have a lot to talk about in today's episode. We will answer a lot of questions that are still puzzling to this very day. What happened to the 10 lost tribes of Israel? Where was the Garden of Eden? Is Noah's Ark buried on Mount Ararat? Is Zimbabwe the final home of the Ark of the Covenant? Was King Arthur a real British warlord? Was there ever a female pope? Who was Prester John? Where is the Holy Grail? How old is the Shroud of Turin? Who was the inspiration for Dracula? Was the Count of Saint-Germain immortal? Did Ponce de Leon find the Fountain of Youth? Are UFOs really alien spaceships? What is hidden at Roswell? And finally, we will ask one last question. Is there a curse on the Bermuda Triangle? A lot to cover, a lot to talk about in another exciting episode from our series, Great Mysteries. Without further ado, let's start with our very first mystery for today, and that is about what happened to the 10 lost tribes of Israel. That's coming next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. In the 10th century BC, 12 tribes occupied Canaan, or the Promised Land. They were descended from and named for the sons or grandsons of Jacob, who was himself the grandson of biblical patriarch Abraham. In 1930 BC, 10 of the tribes, Asher, Dan, Ephraim, Gad, Issachar, Manasseh, Naphtali, Reuben, Simeon, and Zebulun, formed the northern kingdom of Israel. Two others, Judah and Benjamin, formed the kingdom of Judah. Matters stood this way for 200 years, until the Assyrians invaded the north and the 10 tribes vanished from the historical record. Were they simply assimilated? Were they exiled? Do their descendants live on? The fate of the 10 lost tribes fascinated many in the centuries that followed. Jewish traveler Eldad Hadani claimed to have discovered them in the 9th century on the far side of the impassable Sambatian River. Others said they found descendants of the tribes in Persia, which is modern Iran, South America, Afghanistan, South Africa, Japan, and indeed anywhere travelers believe they have seen traces of Hebrew traditions. Various groups claim descent from the lost tribes, but whether any of these assertions are valid is still unknown, and the lost tribes, for now, remain lost. So that was our first mystery for today's episode. And remember, in today's episode, we're focusing on religion, myth, and the supernatural. These three are the topics of today's Great Mysteries episode. And next, we're going to talk about the Garden of Eden. And our question is very simple. Where was the Garden of Eden? That's coming next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. If the biblical Garden of Eden ever existed, where might it have been? According to the book of Genesis, a river flows out of Eden to water the garden. And from there it divides and becomes four branches. The name of the first is Pishon. It is the one that flows around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. Delium and onyx stones are there. The name of the second river is Gihon. It is the one that flows around the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is Tigris, which flows east of Assyria. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. And of course, that comes from the book of Genesis. So these waterways suggest locations perhaps in Iraq, Iran, or Turkey. However, the book of the prophet Ezekiel also refers to Eden on a holy mountain, possibly in what is now Lebanon. Searches for Eden have ventured far afield. If the holy mountain is the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and the original river is the Jordan, Eden could have been in what is now Israel. If the Gihon River is the Nile, as some believe, North Africa might have contained Eden. More creative interpretations have located it in the Seychelles Islands, Jackson County, Missouri, according to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the planet Mars. This last one by an author who connected the Edenic rivers to Martian canals. So, where was that Garden of Eden? Who knows? A lot of interpretations, a lot of places, but we don't know for sure. And for some, maybe it doesn't matter. But anyway, that's one of the great mysteries. And remember, we dedicated this episode to talk about religion, myth, and the supernatural. And that was about the whereabouts of the Garden of Eden. Next, we're going to talk about Noah's Ark. And our question is Noah's Ark buried on Mount Ararat? That's what we're going to find next. So don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. Few biblical stories are better known than that of Noah's Ark. According to the book of Genesis, Noah was chosen by God to safeguard one pair each of the world's animal species on his wooden vessel during a great flood. Earth was inundated, but at the end of 150 days, the waters had abated, and in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And here I quote from the Bible. Now, finding the ark, or what remains of it, has been an obsession for explorers for at least 2,000 years. The mountains of Ararat refer to a region of ancient Armenia. Today, the volcanic massif Mount Ararat in Turkey is the most commonly cited location for the Ark's resting place. Although claims also have been made for Iran and Iraq, among those who have trekked to Ararat is astronaut James Irwin, who joined two unsuccessful expeditions in the 1980s. In 2010, a team from Hong Kong claimed to have found wooden compartments 4,800 years old near the Turkish mountain's peak, without providing further evidence. Most experts are skeptical that the Ark, if it did exist, will be found on Ararat. Even if Ararat is the correct mountain, the Ark wooden remains would have rotted away a long time ago. So will we ever find Noah's Ark? And the big question, yeah, it is a big mystery, but what will we do when we find this Ark? Will that lead us to understand a little more about our origins? Who knows? Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But until now, it is still a mystery, and nobody knows for sure where Noah's Ark is. And that is another mystery to be added to our great mystery series. And today it is about religion, myth, and the supernatural. And next we're going to talk about the Ark of the Covenant. And our question is Zimbabwe the final home of the Ark of the Covenant? That's coming next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. This biblical Ark of the Covenant, described in several books of the Old Testament, was not a sea-going vessel, but, like Noah's Ark, it did hold treasures. Not only did the 4-foot-long, or 1.2 meters, gilded box contain the tablets of the Ten Commandments, it also wielded fearsome power. Carried before the Israelites, it split the waters of the River Jordan. Paraded around Jericho, it helped bring down the city's walls. Finally, the Ark was placed for safekeeping in Jerusalem's first temple built by Solomon. There, its trail ends. When the Babylonians invaded Jerusalem in 586 BC, the temple was destroyed and the Ark vanished from the records. Where could it be? Some believe it is still buried in the Temple Mount. A few European authors believe the Ark was captured by crusaders and taken to France. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church has said it has the Ark in Aksum, Ethiopia, but has not shown it to the public. Recently, Tudor Parfit, a professor at London's School of Oriental and African Studies, linked the Ark to a sacred object in Zimbabwe. There, a clan known as the Lemba claims to have carried away the Ark. Their Ark, Ngoma, is a drum-like container. Carbon dating sets it as younger than the Ark, but Parfit is undeterred. The Ngoma, he believes, may be a replacement or second-generation Ark. But who knows? And the big question is, not only if we find this Ark, does it really have magical powers or superpowers? Who knows? Well, the Bible says it does. Does it really have these magical powers? And does it still exist? And where is it? Is it really in Zimbabwe? That's definitely a great mystery to be added to our great mystery series. And next, we're going to talk about King Arthur. Now, you've all heard of King Arthur, but my question in today's episode, was King Arthur a real British warlord, not this legendary figure? That's what we're going to talk about next, so don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. This is the Arthur most of us know. Now, said Sir Ector to Arthur, I understand you must be king of the land. Wherefore I, said Arthur, and for what cause? Sir, said Ector, for God will have it so, for there should never man have drawn out the sword, but he that shall be rightwise king of this land. By the time Thomas Malory wrote his 15th century romance, Le Mort d'Arthur, King Arthur had become firmly established in British hearts as a ruler of supernatural proportions. Modern historians, however, have debated whether the man ever existed. 6th century Celtic monk Gildas wrote of British battles against Saxon invaders around the year 500, but without mentioning Arthur. 9th century Welsh historian Nennius is the first to place him at the scene as a war leader. Geoffrey of Monmouth's medieval History of the Kings of Britain promotes him to king and adds the figures of Guinevere, Merlin, and others. Historical opinion is now split. Some scholars think that the lack of contemporary accounts of Arthur mean he is a later invention. Others believe that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Well, that's kind of philosophy, I know, but it has a point. Early historians also neglect to name other leaders who we know existed. Now, to finally decide whether King Arthur was a real British warlord, whether he was a warlord or a king, or maybe not exactly like the legend goes, but whether he was a real man or not, maybe the final decision for that still awaits some archaeological proof yet to be found. So, that was another mystery for our today's episode, and personally, I like the story of King Arthur. I don't care if King Arthur was a real man or not, but the story is so nice, and I really like everything about King Arthur and the Arthurian legends. But anyway, I'm not saying that it was true or not, I have no idea, it's still a mystery, right? And next mystery, we're gonna talk about another figure, and we're gonna ask the question whether this figure was real or not, but here we're gonna talk about a pope, and not any pope. Was there ever a female pope? That's coming next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. The tale took hold in the 13th century and soon became accepted as fact. According to several medieval chroniclers, when Pope Leo IX died in 855, he was succeeded by a brilliant Englishman, John of Mainz. John had occupied the seat for something over 2 years when, during a procession in Rome, he was overcome with pains. To the astonishment of onlookers, he gave birth to a son and died. Pope John had been Pope Joan all along. For several centuries, the public believed in the historical truth of the female pope. Her bust stood, among others, in the Siena Cathedral, and Renaissance historians included her in their accounts. Papal processions avoided the route on which Joan supposedly gave birth. Protestant critics of the church, in particular, enjoyed rehashing the story. Over time, however, scholars pointed out that Pope Leo IX was actually succeeded in 855 by Benedict III. No contemporary accounts mention a female pope, and it is highly unlikely that she ever existed. But again, the church back then had the power to cover up the whole story and erase it from history at that time. Who knows? I'm not saying that this happened or that happened. I'm just wondering, like everybody else. And anyway, the legend of unlucky Pope Joan has persisted. Plays, novels, and movies continue to feature the learned but all too fertile pope. So, was there ever a female pope? That's another mystery that we should add to our great mystery series. And next, we're gonna talk about Prester John. Who was Prester John? That's coming next. Don't go anywhere, I'll be right back. A Around the year 1165, Byzantine Emperor Manuel Komnenos received a surprising letter. The man who sent it claimed to be no less than the greatest king the world had ever known, and Christian to boot. He reigned over a rich and exotic kingdom to the east. And here I quote, 72 kingships serve us in bondage. That's what he wrote. That's what was written in the letter. His land included such creatures as elephants, griffins, ogresses, giants, and satyrs. There were no poor, no adulterers, no thieves, nor misers in Prester John's land. But the greatest music to European ears was the news that Prester John intended to bring an army to the Holy Land to fight the Muslims. Pope Alexander III learned of the letter and wrote back eagerly without any known reply. There followed hundreds of years of exploration into Africa and Asia in search of the mysterious Christian monarch. A monk named John de Piano Caprini suffered much hardship in a journey to the Mongol leader Kuyu Khan, only to learn that he was neither Prester John nor a Christian. Marco Polo looked for the ruler during his travels. Portuguese explorers Bartolomeo Dias and Vasco da Gama also failed to find him, but did open a route to India. Gradually, discouragement set in and Prester John receded into fable. Today, the verdict of historians regarding the 1165 letter is that it was a big medieval practical joke. And I have to say, if it was indeed a practical joke, that would be the best practical joke I have ever heard of. But anyway, it is still a mystery. No one can say for sure if there was ever a Prester John, or if there was this Prester John, whether he was that powerful, or was it just simply a practical joke. No evidence to back either explanation. So that is another mystery to add to our great mystery series. And next, we're going to talk about something as mysterious. We're going to talk about the Holy Grail. And we'll talk about the whereabouts of the Holy Grail. Though it is traditionally held to be the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper, the Holy Grail as such did not appear in literature until the 12th century, when French poet Chrétien de Troyes, or Troyer, I'm not sure, wrote Percival, The Story of the Holy Grail. In this unfinished romance, the Grail is a serving dish, one of several mystical objects paraded before the young Percival. The Grail was not associated with the Last Supper until the next century in Robert de Boron's poem Joseph of Arimathea. From there, the legend of the Grail blossomed along the Arthurian romances in a mix of Celtic and Christian symbolism, fact and fancy. It was the object of literary quests, particularly that of the pure Sir Galahad. Some said the Knights Templar rescued it from Jerusalem and hid it all too successfully. Many locations from Spain to Maryland have claimed to possess the true Grail. The Grail is almost certainly a purely literary invention. Historians believe that if any cup used by Jesus did somehow survive all these centuries, it would be unidentifiable today, hidden indeed by time. So, is there really a Holy Grail? And what if it were the cup that Jesus used in the Last Supper? Would it have some magical powers, as some people believe? But anyway, let's get back to the original question, and that is, where is the Holy Grail? That we still don't know. Many claim to know where it is, and of course, if you read Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown or watched the movie, you know that he took it in a totally different direction. So the Holy Grail is still rich material for literature, stories, and even movies. And that's because it's still a mystery. And that's why it is part of our great mystery series. And next, as we're still talking about religion, myth, and supernatural, we're going to talk about the Shroud of Turin. And the question is, how old is the Shroud of Turin? That's coming next. I'll be right back. The Shroud of Turin may be real, or it may be a hoax, but it certainly reveals the limits of science in resolving the controversy. The shroud is a long, rectangular, flaxen cloth that many believe to be Jesus' burial wrappings. Faintly visible on its surface, and of course, more evident in photographs, is the image of a naked, bearded man with wounds like those suffered by Jesus at his death. The shroud is currently held in Turin's Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. The shroud's validity had been debated since it first came to view in the 14th century. In 1988, three independent carbon dating tests put its origins between 1260 and 1390 AD, long after Jesus' death. In 2005, a scientist asserted that the tests were performed on patched areas and that the shroud was much older. This claim, in turn, was disputed. In 2013, scientists from the University of Padua retested the fibers from 1988 and dated them to between 300 BC and 400 AD, which is obviously the time of Christ. On Easter Sunday, 2013, Pope Francis I spoke of the shroud with a mixture of reverence and caution, saying, "The man of the shroud invites us to contemplate Jesus of Nazareth." So whether the cloth is historically valid, not even the Pope is prepared to say. But again, I know it's a matter of faith, and I respect all people's faith, of course. And if it is just about a faith, sometimes it doesn't matter if something is real or not. What matters is what you believe. Because after all, you're not going to worship a piece of cloth. You're going to worship what it represents. So maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe some people would kill me for saying that. But all I'm saying is that objects, of course, sacred objects, are important. And we go to great lengths to prove they're authentic. But after all, they're just representations of something a lot bigger based on any faith that you have. So maybe it shouldn't be a big deal whether it is real or not. And again, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm just saying what objects represent are far more important than the objects themselves. And that's what Pope Francis said. He said, "The man of the shroud invites us to contemplate Jesus of Nazareth, what the shroud really represents." So, not my words. Anyway, we will move along, and next, we're going to talk about Count Dracula. Who was the inspiration for Count Dracula? That's coming next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. The gentlemanly antagonist of Bram Stoker's 1897 novel Dracula was not the first blood drinker to appear in fiction. John Polidori's The Vampire and James Rymer's Varney the Vampire, among others, predated Stoker's work. But Count Dracula became the iconic vampire, a character so potent that many readers wondered if the undead aristocrat could have been based on a real person. Stoker was familiar with vampires from folktales and other fictional sources. But he apparently took the name Dracula from an account of the principalities of Wallachia and Moldavia by William Wilkinson, who was a British diplomat. In his book, Wilkinson describes the historical figure Vlad III Dracula, born in Transylvania and Prince of Wallachia during the mid-1400s. In the course of attempts to gain his father's throne, Vlad became known for his atrocities, particularly for his habit of impaling enemies by the thousands. Other accounts had him skinning, boiling, or burning alive the poor and gypsies. As bloodthirsty as Vlad the Impaler was, metaphorically, one thing the histories do not relate is an actual habit of drinking blood. That taste was left to his fictional heir, the Transylvanian Count Dracula. So that was about Dracula, and whether the real inspiration for Dracula was Vlad the Impaler or not, and we've seen that even in recent movies, we've seen that it was Vlad the Impaler, and then he turned to be Count Dracula, the vampire, etc. But of course, here we're not talking about whether vampires exist or not. That's not even a mystery, in my opinion. But the mysterious question here was who the inspiration for Dracula was. And next, we're going to talk about something as mysterious, and we're going to talk about the Count of Saint Germain. And the question is, was the Count of Saint Germain immortal? That's what we're going to find out next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. A true man of mystery, Claude-Louis Comte de Saint Germain was accomplished, influential, and, according to some, immortal. He appeared in European courts in the mid-1700s. Horace Walpole wrote of this odd man in 1745. He said he has been here these 2 years and will not tell who he is or whence. He sings, plays on the violin wonderfully, composes, is mad, and not very sensible. He is called an Italian, a Spaniard, a Pole, a somebody that married a great fortune in Mexico and ran away with her jewels to Constantinople, a priest, a fiddler, a vast nobleman. Here I end quote. He was said to be a spy, celibate, and ambidextrous. Saint Germain was in fact a diplomat, possibly a spy, and also by his account, hundreds of years old. According to Casanova, who met him in 1757, and here I quote, "This extraordinary man, intended by nature to be the king of imposters and quacks, would say in an easy, assured manner that he was 300 years old, that he knew the secret of the universal medicine, that he possessed a mastery over nature, that he could melt diamonds." So who's this Count Saint Germain? Who he really was is still unknown. But he was, unfortunately, not immortal. He died in Germany in 1784 at the age of 188, 223, or 2000, depending upon the source. Nobody can tell you for sure how long he lived. Now, I know that most of you don't even believe in that, but it is a mystery, and some people might still believe that Count Saint Germain was, almost immortal. And from the immortality of Count Saint-Germain, let's move on to Ponce de Leon and whether he found the Fountain of Youth or not. That's coming next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. Often invoked, but never discovered, the Fountain of Youth has been the object of many a hopeful quest. The ancient Greeks, medieval Arabs, and others featured a restorative fountain or river in romantic tales. Perhaps the best-known Fountain of Youth, however, is the one that Spanish explorer Juan Ponce de Leon is said to have been searching for in Florida. Except he probably wasn't. Ponce de Leon, who was the colonial governor of Puerto Rico from 509 to 511, was looking for gold, land, and native peoples to enslave when he set out to find an island known as Bimini in 1513. Instead, he reached the coast of Florida, visiting the new land twice over the next few years before being fatally wounded by a native's arrow. Only in later accounts did chroniclers, possibly mocking the explorer, claim that he was looking for the legendary fountain. Antonio Herrera de Tordesillas wrote, "He had an account of the wealth of this island," which here we talk about Bimini, "and especially that singular fountain that the Indians spoke of that turned men from old men into boys." Ponce's lack of success has not stopped the Florida city of St. Augustine from establishing a Fountain of Youth archaeological park near a natural hot spring. But of course, the question still stands, even if it is something that is kind of unbelievable. Of course, we're talking about the Fountain of Youth. Maybe some fountains are good for your health that can rejuvenate you in a way, but not actually turn you into a boy like we see in the movies or in some fiction. But anyway, was he searching for this Fountain of Youth, or did he find it, or at least did he think he found it? Who knows? That's still a mystery, and that's why it's one of our great mysteries. And next, we're going to talk about UFOs, and we're going to answer the question, are UFOs really alien spaceships? That's coming next. Don't go anywhere. There is no doubt that UFOs truly exist, if we go by the strict meaning of the term, unidentified flying object. Whether the many sightings of UFOs over the years include alien spaceships, that is the question. That is actually what's questionable. Mysterious aerial objects have been reported since ancient times, but the trickle of reports swelled into a flood in the age of flight. In 1896 and 1897, for instance, West Coast residents from San Francisco to Tacoma, Washington, reported a bright, circular-shaped, dirigible object wandering slowly overhead. Sightings increased in the years after World War II. In 1947, pilot Kenneth Arnold spotted a formation of bright objects skipping over the Cascade Mountains. And here I quote, he said, "They flew like a saucer would if you skipped it across the water." That's what he told reporters. Though the objects he saw were crescent-shaped, the term flying saucer took hold in the public mind. The U.S. military took such sightings seriously in those Cold War days. The Air Force set up a series of investigations from the 1940s to the 1960s, the most famous of which was Project Blue Book. It concluded that 94% of some 12,000 sightings could be attributed to natural causes, such as the planet Venus, meteors, or ordinary aircraft. 6% were unexplained. Certainly, some UFO photographs were hoaxes, with examinations revealing wires holding up the pie plate like saucers. Nonetheless, the unexplained sightings led some sober scientists, including astronomer J. Allen Hynek, to believe that a few visitors might indeed be extraterrestrial. Hynek's Center for UFO Studies has been joined by other organizations in tracking UFO reports. The jury is still out on whether these unexplained objects represent alien aircraft, but most scientists, seeing no hard proof, are skeptical about that. And I have to say that I am skeptical about that, but I'm not ruling out the possibility of those sightings to be real alien ships. Who knows? There might have been some visitors, and what they're trying to do and why they're here, we don't know. Because, at least for me, I'm not saying that I have the evidence. Of course I don't. For me, it's kind of difficult to believe that we are alone in this big universe. Or as some people believe that this universe was created for us. I mean, come on, people. Why are we so important so that the whole universe, I mean, the Earth is enough, the solar system is enough for us as species, and we've been here for what, like a couple of million years? And the universe has been there for billions of years. So anyway, it's kind of difficult to believe that we are alone in this universe, but we still haven't seen any extraterrestrials or aliens. Maybe we will see some of them in the future, but that is still a mystery, of course. We don't have a definitive answer for that, and that's why it's part of our great mysteries. And by the way, before I continue with our next mystery, us not being alone is going to be the topic of our upcoming series after we finish this series, and this series is going to be called Beyond Earth. We're going to talk about planets, stars, black holes, and a lot of other interesting things in Beyond Earth series. So stay tuned for that. That's coming pretty soon. Anyway, let's get back to our great series. And we still have two more questions for today's episode. And since we're talking about aliens, let's move along and talk about what is hidden at Roswell. That's our next question. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. The incident at Roswell is possibly the most controversial of all UFO sightings. In July of 1947, witnesses saw objects in the sky over Roswell, New Mexico, and heard a loud crash. In the next few days, the local sheriff and a major from the Roswell Army Airfield collected some curious metallic debris from a local field. Then the Army issued a remarkable press release. And the press release goes like, "The many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday when the intelligence office of the 509th Bomb Group of the 8th Air Force, Roswell Army Airfield, was fortunate enough to gain possession of a disc." End quote. So that press release was unprecedented, and we're talking about reliable sources here, right? But shortly afterward, the Army issued another statement that essentially said, "Never mind, the debris was nothing but a weather balloon." So it might have been a cover-up, it might not, who knows. But from there, the story of an Army cover-up took off. Accounts emerged of a second crash site and odd corpses. In 1997, the Air Force issued a report saying that these were crash test dummies. Some Army and Air Force officers still claim that the debris found was from a UFO. Skeptics say the incident is a classic case of mythologizing. No evidence exists of alien bodies or UFO remains stored at Roswell, but the controversy lives on. So whether that is true or not, whether there were some alien spaceships there or not, whether that was a cover-up or not, maybe the first Army press release was a little bit hasty and they just jumped to conclusions that it was an alien airship and it wasn't. Maybe it was a cover-up. Who knows? And what we know for sure is that time will tell and we will know about that, or maybe our children or our grandchildren will know about that. But anyway, The thing is, it's still one of the big mysteries, and that's why it's part of our Great Mysteries series. And that's not the last question. The next one is the last question. And our final mystery for today, or our final question for today, is about the Bermuda Triangle. Is there a curse on the Bermuda Triangle? That's what we're going to talk about next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. Writer Vincent Gaddis was the first to suggest that the region of ocean bounded by Miami, Bermuda, and Puerto Rico, an area he dubbed the Bermuda Triangle, was cursed. Writing in Argosy magazine in 1964, he told the story of the five bombers of ill-fated Navy Flight 19. After taking off from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on a routine training mission in 1945, the planes reported compass problems and eventually fell silent, never returning to base. 14 men were lost. After Gaddis' story came out, fans of the paranormal began to collect other tales of ships and planes lost in the Bermuda Triangle, portraying it as a region where compasses fail and an unusual number of people simply vanish. Alien abductions, space vortices, and energies from Atlantis were put forward to explain the disappearances. However, reviews of incidents in the area have shown that they are no more prevalent than any other heavily traveled part of the ocean. Bordered by the Gulf Stream, the warm waters are naturally stormy and subject to rogue waves. As the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration notes, the combined forces of nature and human fallibility outdo even the most incredulous science fiction. So, is there a curse on the Bermuda Triangle? Well, I don't think so. Well, it is still a mystery for some people, and that's why I included it in our Great Mystery series. But personally, I don't believe there is a curse. But after all, I may be wrong, and I may not be sure about a lot of things, but I'm sure this is the last mystery I'm going to talk about in today's episode of our Great Mystery series. This is your host, Danny. Thank you very much for listening. I will see you next time.